This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This is C-SPAN's Lectures in History podcast. This week, Professor Maurice Jackson talks about the philosophy of W.E.B. Du Bois, an influential African-American sociologist, author, and civil rights activist in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. He describes Du Bois' early life, his role as an educator, and his relationship with other activists of the time.
Well, so thank you. Today we will discuss the works of W.E.B. Du Bois. As you know, we've just ended African American History Month, and Carter G. Woodson established that in 1926, and he established for four reasons. One was it was the birthday of Frederick Douglass. We don't know the exact date, the birthday of Abraham Lincoln, who established the Emancipation Proclamation, and also the birthday of W.E.B. Du Bois. Du Bois was born February 23rd, 1868, in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. My wife was pregnant with our second child, and she went in labor on February 22nd. And so as we went to the hospital, I said, dear, if you have this child tonight, he'll be born on George Washington's birthday. And I didn't say anything about Mr. Washington. But if you hold out a couple of hours, we'll have a Du Bois baby. And you can imagine, young men and ladies, what you would say to your husband 10 or 15 years down the road. You would, you know, call him every name but a child of God, as she called me. But he was born on February 23rd, so we do have a Du Bois birthday. And in a course like this, talking about freedom, there's just no person that exemplifies the struggle of freedom in America and in the world, philosophically and socially, more than W.E.B. Du Bois. And he became famous for his many writings. So let's just look at a bit of his life and his sayings. His early years, he's born in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. As he's born there, he's born to his mother and father. His father, Alfred, left the family not long after he was born. His grandfather, Alexander, was of Haitian background, spent some time in Santo Domingo, and ran a store up in Great Barrington. His grandfather had some goings back to Haiti, some mixture we just don't know. His grandmother, Burkhardt, so no doubt some German mixture somewhere along the line. Du Bois once said, when they asked him what was his makeup, he says, I'm a little German, a little French, a little Haitian, a little Dutch, but thank God, no Anglo-Saxon. And of course, what would he mean by that? The Anglo-Saxons were, of course, the original people who traded in slaves. And therefore, we can see a bit of the early life and the early years of Du Bois there. At age of 12, he purchased a copy of Macaulay's History of England. And this becomes very important because this is a book that people salesmen would take door to door. And as a young boy, he read this five or six volumes. It's like the Encyclopedia Britannica, I guess you would say. And he went from page to page reading the history of the world and the history of the ancient world. And it instilled in him this great pride. And understanding Great Barrington, there were no other blacks, maybe one or two families. And he was a precocious young man, but very early he became attuned to the study of books. He didn't want to let his mother down. She wanted to educate his son, her only child. And in the school with many whites, he excelled probably more than others. And in a place like that, you know how it is with children, people accept each other. Races and cultures don't really matter that much. It's how good you can play the game, how you can play a jump rope, how you can bring your mother's cookies to school and all those type of things. And so he had never had any racial incidents until one day He goes to school, and kids are passing cards. Cards, you know, they like greeting cards, and they exchange them each other. And this one girl wouldn't accept his card. And then he saw the first racial incidents. If you are African American, or perhaps Spanish, or some other ethnic minority who's come and can be considered oppressed, you most likely remember the first time you had a racial incident. I can remember exactly the first time I did. It was in the South. My brother and I were walking. Someone was driving a pickup truck, and he said, "I smell a gar." And he said, "What kind of gar?" And he said, "A knee," and you can know the rest of the words are there. And I can remember just as it were yesterday. But generally, when people make racial epithets, they're always going away from you, never coming towards you. So he early recognized that. His talents were recognized very early. And so he excelled in school. His mother told a story of once he wanted some German textbooks. He didn't have the money to buy them. He had worked in little stores in the morning and things like that. His best friend, Lucas, had a... he was somewhat mentally challenged, I guess would be the best word. And he had some difficulties in learning, but they became best friends. And his friend's mother bought him the set of German books. The mother would never accept anything from anybody else, Du Bois's mother, but in this case, she did for his son. And he excelled early on in German and won many of the debate prizes. The people in town saw how talented this young man was, and so they wanted to make sure he went to college, and he applied to many. But, of course, he was from Great Barrington, and so he would, of course, want to go to Harvard. And that was his dream school. As they took up money, the people who owned the stores and others raising the money for him to go his first year, but not to Harvard, because they could accept him as a black man, as a smart black man, but not to their premier institution. So instead, he went for 2 years at Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee. And at Fisk, of course, he excelled. He'd never been down south. And his early years there became very important to him. He left and went to, as he went to Fisk University, and this is Livingston Hall, the main hall on the campus. Even when I went there, many, many years later for a year or two, a young man would walk up and they could never go into the dorm because it was just all girls. And Fisk became famous for its Jubilee Singers. School opened in 1866. He went there later. And the Jubilee Singers, as we've talked before, were the authors of the modern version of the Negro spirituals. And in fact, to stay the school, the choir traveled throughout the world and sang many, many songs. Now, we'll come back to it in a moment. But at Fisk, he learned something that he had not seen before. He went down south, and he went to other parts of Tennessee, Fisk, Nashville, Tennessee, and there, for the first time, he saw poverty, the poverty of his people. He saw blacks who couldn't read and write, people who walked around barefoot, people who had spittoons and things in the house. They taught them slop jars. He saw people who had to wash their clothes outside with the boiling pots. He saw the experience of people, none who'd ever gone to school. And as you read The Souls of Black Folks, you read about a young girl named Josie and others. At Fisk, however, he excelled. And in his work, he finished in a four-year course in 2 years. Then he applied to Harvard, and then he was accepted, where he encouraged a rigorous study there. At Harvard, and you can see, he studied with the great philosophers of in American history. First, Albert Bushnell Hart was one of the great historians in America. He's one of the first great ones that of the 19th century. And Hart was an empiricist in all things. He taught Du Bois the importance of learning facts and of writing well. George Santayana, the sociologist, and William James, of course, the writer. And he wrote he won a prize in his senior year. And he wrote, of all people, on Jefferson Davis. And he wrote about Jefferson Davis in the South and the rise of slavery. From there, he applied to graduate school, but first he wanted to go to Germany. And he wanted to go to Germany for several reasons. First, because of the way under the von Ranke school and others, the way women learn empirical knowledge, the ability to use facts. Has anybody ever seen the film Kojak, the movie Kojak? The bald-head guy, and he says, "Just the facts, baby." And so Du Bois wanted to learn the facts. "Show me the facts, and I can interpret it myself." Remember, the Quaker said, "I don't need the word of the preacher. Just show me the way, and I'll find the Bible myself." And so Du Bois very much was in that sense. He spent 2 years in Germany. He wanted to get a doctorate in Germany there at Humboldt University, but the German peers resented him because he was in many ways smarter than them. He hadn't and protested, and he did not get his doctorate there. At the same time, when he was in Germany, he has different feelings. He sees the racism of his fellow students, yet as he walks around in Germany, he sees something different. He doesn't experience that racism. It is what he became later on. He talks about the dualness of things. At Germany, of course, as you see, he studied economics at Wilhelm University. And he studied political economy. Political economy is the development of ideas based on the ideas of Ricardo, Perry, and, of course, later on, Karl Marx in the theory of political economy, the use of economic structures to understand the modern world using the theories of Hegel and the dialectical theory of Hegel's that we've spoke about before. And he started looking at concepts of race and pan-Germanism. And he saw race is a positive and undeniable force in history. In other words, being black was not a negative for him. It was a positive. It was who he was, and he wanted to explore that. And later on, he came back to look at it. We look again. After he left Germany, he went back to Harvard and completed his doctoral studies. And in the last year, as he's writing, he takes a job at Wilberforce University. He had looked at many schools all over. He'd applied, and just May, he could not get a job. They taught classics in modern language. And by the classics, that means Greek and Latin. He also taught science and biology. He developed two lists when he was there. He was a young man in town. And, of course, he was wearing the top hat, as Germans wear. He wore three-piece suits all the time. He wore spats on his shoes. And he's there. He invites dinners almost every night. And, of course, he's a young man there. He's alone. And so, as a young man, he's thinking maybe about marriage or future or his future. And so he saw all these young ladies, and everybody was invited to dinner and the families. And so he made two lists. And on one list, it was the young women who could do what? Could speak French. What else? Could cook. Could serve tea and set a table. And then on another list, it was those who had great intelligence. And so as he made the list, he had one woman that was on both. And, of course, this does sound a bit silly, but it's actually true. And on the list, this is the woman who found a boat, Nina Goma. And soon he married her, and not long later they had children. In the process of doing this, he finished his doctoral thesis at Harvard University. And his doctoral thesis is a classic, Suppression of the African Slave Trade in the United States of America. And what this study did more than any, it looked at every state legislature, everybody, and developed a list and documentation about the way the slave trade worked in each and every state and where slaves had come from the other regions. The first time it had ever been done. And he did it based on his empirical knowledge of facts and going back through every colonial constitution, South Carolina, Virginia, and others. And as he said, he wanted to make the connection between scholarly inquiry and truth. In American history, there are many schools of social thought are doing that time. Some are called the National School, and the National School was that school only to preserve the integrity of America as it saw it. Another school was called the Imperial School, and the Imperial School was to reflect the idea of British imperialism, of the British society. And then, of course, later on, the Progressive School, which sought to include Africans in the equation, but not just as slaves, but as men and women. So he wrote this book. It came out in the Harvard series, inaugural series in Harvard Historical Studies, and became a classic in its own day. African Slave Trade, 1638 to 1870, suppression of that trade. Of course, as we know, this international slave trade ends in 1808, but slavery continued in America until 1865, until the Civil War. While at Wilberforce then, in the first year, he finishes this study and becomes Dr. Du Bois. He applies for other jobs. Wilberforce is, in many ways, a stifling place, not too many places to go. Du Bois was an erudite man. He liked opera. He liked concerts. He liked museums. He wanted to, and he applied for jobs, and lo and behold, he got a job in Philadelphia. And in Philadelphia, he got a job working on a study of the city. And what he was to do was to study the plight of Africans in the African Americans in that city, to look at their social economic conditions, their folk life, the folklores, and get an idea about them. And it became the first empirical sociological work of its kind. In fact, this ushered in the period of what we call urban sociology. And he went ward by ward. Wards in D.C., of course, the 8 wards, you know, the UN ward, are 3 here. You heard of in New Orleans where the flood was, it was what? The lower 9th. Well, he went into the 8th ward and spent hours and hours. Now, here's a man attuned to all the great languages and empirical learning, and he goes door to door. There should be 4 people doing it, but they only hire him one. And then, and this is a study, this is where he went map to map, interviewing people. And it really set the stage for what we see now is the modern interviews. As you know, when people want to see the type of people who are going to vote, they do it. Now they say it, they can do what? They can say, working class whites are voting for Donald Trump. You answer that to me. I don't know why they would. African Americans in the South, they can look at the numbers and they can say many will go for Mrs. Clinton. They can go to Vermont and other places and see who's voting for who based on polls, based on study of ethnicity. Du Bois was the first to actually do this. Ward by ward. And at the end of this, it came a book called The Philadelphia Negro. Now, in The Philadelphia Negro, he also did something else. He paid great tributes to the role of the Quakers, and I've spoke about the Quakers before. And he's played great role in the education of blacks in Philadelphia to this man, Anthony Benezet, who I've spoken to you before, Anthony Benezet, who became the founder of modern anti-slavery movement. But the beauty of Benezet, as Du Bois as I spoke, was that he founded the first school for blacks, a continuous school for blacks in Philadelphia, and one of the first few in America, the African Free School. And, of course, in the other book, Suppression of Slave Trade, he said, on motion of one, probably Anthony Benezet, a resolution was put forth to call for the Quakers to bring an end to slavery in America. And so he had great appreciation for that. The next year, he got a job and he moved to Atlanta, Georgia, and there to work at the Atlanta University. And there he taught sociology and empirical studies. And empirical studies could mean statistics, could mean some forms of science. Again, he taught Greek and Latin. And his son, Burgard, of course, Burgard after his mother's family name, Goma Du Bois. Goma, of course, after the mother. Has anybody ever watched the Andy Griffin Show? Nobody, Mike. And what is the other guy's name? Goma Powell. So Goma it can be a southern name, but in this case, it's a northern name. And he has a son, Burgard, who's born. And you can see how beautiful and precocious the little lad is. You see the kind of dress that he has. Looks like a young girl's dress, but that is the way of the Victorian style. And Du Bois is very much a Victorian. The child gets sick. He takes him throughout Atlanta. No white doctor will help him. It would have been common. It would have been common up until probably the late 60s in some places. And he couldn't find a doctor. And so the son dies of a disease which he could have easily been cured of. From that, Du Bois wrote one of his great works on the passing of the firstborn. And it's, in his book, The Souls of Black Folks, and we'll come to that later. But while Du Bois is there studying this, he noticed other things, other tragedies occur. And one is the tragedy of lynching. He's walking somewhere, and he passes a place, and there's a Klan rally and a Klan display, and there he comes upon a jar. And it looks very much like pickles in a jar, which you've seen. But instead of pickles, what are they? They're the knuckles of a human being. I can remember being in the South in the late 60s and early 70s, and I actually have seen men's body parts put in pickle jars outside of Southern Klansmen's building there. It was a token of the repression, a token of the fear that we've spoken about. And the same year he sees that, he starts documenting certain lynchings. Remember the year he was born, 1868, 291 blacks are lynched. The years he's in Atlanta in the early 1900s, you can see the numbers are lynched. And, of course, we're talking about lynchings before. Du Bois, as he continues scientific research, he gets a post to work to begin a study of the American Negro, as he said. He did it with the work of A.P. Murray, who was an African-American, a printer from a prestigious family, who was at the Library of Congress. And he starts putting together an exhibit on the achievements of the African-American man at dawn of the 20th century. 500 photographs and many pictures of scientific and technological process of Africans. And as he's there at the Paris Exposition, he wears the clothes that that he had worn in Germany. Top hat, three-piece suit, vest, pocket watch, pocket square, very much the Victorian. And as he's there, he used his theories to contradict and chastise and criticize the theories of Booker T. Washington, which we've spoken about. Booker T. Washington had spoken at the Cotton States exhibit a couple of years before, and with his famous saying, as you know, cast down your bucket where you are. Cast down your bucket. And as you put your hand to pick it up, your hands can operate in two ways. In all things economic, they can be as one. But in all things social, they will be as separate as the five fingers. And, of course, we know that there is no such thing as separate but equal. But Booker T. Washington put forth the theory that Du Bois was now challenging, and we'll speak a bit about it more on the Paris exhibit. In 1903, he published his magisterial work, is perhaps what people call the Negro Bible, and that's the souls of black folks. He becomes the preeminent voice when he writes this. Souls of Black Folks is written first in serial form in a Dial magazine and some articles in Atlantic Monthly. And as you look in the book, you can see that he does something unique. He has a verse, which is a verse of a Negro spiritual, and then he'll have a poem on the other side, very much in tradition of Du Bois and his own work. Very much like this. You see the poem on one side and this. His famous poem was one of a favorite poem was one that Dr. King always read. And this is by James Russell Lowell, the great poet. And the most famous lines are, "Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet the scaffold sways the future, in behind the dim unknown, standing of God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own." And of course, King used that. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. And what does that mean? Just off your head. Truth forever on the scaffold. And what is a scaffold? I mean, what is a scaffold? Just off your head. If you're an artist, you know what a scaffold is. Isn't it a
framework?
It's a framework. It's a frame. It's like a ladder. It's something you stand on. As I told you, I used to work on ships for some years. And I'd go out in the middle of the ocean, and they would build scaffolds because it's cheaper to work on a ship out in the ocean. If you've gone to the Washington Monument, you see the scaffolds, right? And the men and women, in this case, go up on the scaffolds to help. If you want to paint, they don't do it now, but in the old days, if they were painting a building like let's say, Healy Hall, and it's made of hard plaster, men would go on the scaffold and paint. If you watched anybody paint the Cistern Temple, how are they painting? They build up a scaffold, and they have to go on it, and they lay on their back. As you know, Michelangelo laid on his back for a long time to paint. And scaffold, truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. So what is he saying? Truth forever on the scaffold, and the scaffold represents who? What does the scaffold represent? It represents the average human being, the working man and woman. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. The throne represents what? Off your head. What does the throne represent? The high and the mighty, the kings, the ones whose words you must always follow. But the truth will last forever, and a lie will stand alone. So see, they're playing with words. And so he used those as he thinks about the souls of black folks, the dualness of people. And with this, he wrote this book, and it became many ways called the Negro Bible. It's written in three parts, one part historical, one part sociological, and one part deeply spiritual. And I played in this class some of the Negro spirituals for you. And you can see the names of some of those, if you look on the side there. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen, and that was the poem. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Nobody knows. Anybody know the words? Huh? My sorrow. Okay, but before that, nobody knows but Jesus. Now, in the original way, it was nobody knows like Jesus. And there's a difference between like Jesus and but Jesus. And the civil rights people later on changed the words. If you said like Jesus, then you mean somebody else does know the troubles. If you say nobody knows but Jesus, it means what? Only Jesus knows. If you say like Jesus, then you mean that other people can join you in the struggle, that you have not given up. If you say but Jesus, it means that you only look for salvation or freedom in heaven. And so the words steal away to Jesus, steal away home. And stealing away to Jesus means what? Stealing away to heaven. But stealing away home means stealing away to freedom. And others, swing low, sweet chariot. Come in for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot. If you get there before I do, tell all God's children, I'm coming too. And so swing low, sweet chariot means that if you get to heaven before I do, tell everybody how good heaven is. But if you get to freedom, you tell them what? I'm coming too. I'm coming after you. So he used those beautiful terms. And he wrote about the meaning of the spirituals. He called them sorrow songs. But he called them sorrow songs because they tell of death, suffering, and unvoiced longing toward a truer world of mystery, wanderings, and hidden ways. Now, Du Bois spoke of them as sorrow songs, as I mentioned before in class. Frederick Douglass looked at them a little bit differently because Douglass says that that often a people who are oppressed sing, and they sing to sometimes forget it or so, but also think about them. I'm happiest when I sing, but also I can be sad when I sing. And so you look at the different songs. As I told you about the blues, people will sing the blues. Do they sing the blues when they're happy, or do they sing the blues when they're sad? You don't always sing the blues when you're sad. Ray Charles, I got a woman way across town. She's good to me. She's good to me. She gives me loving and money, too, and nothing for me that she wouldn't do. Is he sad? He's only sad one time. And that's when his wife catches him with the lady over town. Otherwise, he doesn't have the blues. But it is the blues. And if I've often said, sometimes you listen to country western music, which I do sometimes on Sunday mornings because there's no other good music on. It's nothing but the white man's blues. So there are different forms as we listen to that. And now, in his book, he takes on, again, The Souls of Black Folks, Booker T. Washington. And Booker T. Washington, of course, is the leader of African Americans at the time. And Du Bois says this: easily the most striking thing in the history of the Negro since 1867 is the ascendancy of Mr. Booker T. Washington. It began at a time of war memories and ideals were rapidly passing. A day of astonishing commercial developments was dawning. A sense of doubt and hesitation overtook the freedman's son. Then it was this leading man began in his career of Booker T. Washington with a single definite program. At the psychological moment when the nation was a little ashamed of having bestowed so much sentiment on the Negro, it was concentrating his energies elsewhere. His program of industrial education, conciliation to the South, and a submission in silence to political rights. And so he challenged the idea of Booker T. Washington, which was to accept things as they are, to go slow, to just participate in industrial education. And the best way to establish the difference between Booker T. and W.B. was this poem by a great poet, Dudley Randall, wrote in 1969 at the height of the Black Power movement. It seems to me, said Booker T., it shows a mighty lot of cheek to study chemistry and Greek. When Mr. Charlie needs a hand to hold the cotton on this land, and when Miss Ann looks for a cook, why not stick? Why stick your nose inside a book? I don't agree, said W.B. As I should have the drive to seek knowledge of chemistry or Greek, I'll do it. Charles and Miss can look another place for hand to cook. Some men rejoice of skill in hand and cultivating in land, but there are things others who maintain the right to cultivate the brain. And so what is he saying there? It's the struggle between industrial education and advanced education, between menial education and the right to knowledge. And Du Bois and Booker T. Took on this with glee. Now, it's very interesting about Booker T. because Booker T., even though he disagreed with Du Bois' programs, and in one case in the early 1900s, when Du Bois was looking for a job, and couldn't, he's moved all over. He wanted to come and become assistant principal of the public schools in Washington, D.C., of the Negro schools, and Booker T. Washington undermined the effort. But when he was at Wilberforce some years before and applied for a job, come to find out one of his classmates, Margaret, who had been at Fisk, was Booker T. Washington's second wife. His first wife had died, and Margaret was there at Tuskegee, and Booker T. Washington offered him a job at Tuskegee, but this is before Booker T. Washington, W. Du Bois, so openly disagreed with his policies. A year or so later, he founded something called the Niagara Movement. Niagara Movement was the forefront of the NAACP. They met in, Du Bois would say Niagara, but Niagara Falls. He was joined by other great leaders, William Monroe Trotter and Ida B. Wells. Ida B. Wells from Memphis, Tennessee, who had become the great writer against lynchings in the South. And they both wanted to start, they all three wanted to start this to refute the idea of Booker T. Washington's submissive fight. It was time for blacks to fight. And Du Bois listed three things, the right to education, the right to vote, and the right to full participation in the American political system. And he challenged, and so all of these people came and met in Niagara near the Canadian border to found this organization called the Niagara Movement. And the next year, and you can see the dates with it, 1905 until 1909. In 1909, they had an initial meeting at Harper's Ferry. Harper's Ferry represents what? Harper's Ferry is the place where John Brown had his raid, and there, and of course, they are black and white because the people who found in NAACP are some very wealthy white philanthropists, and of course, many black leaders. And they found this at Harper's Ferry in 1909. The journal that they find, the magazine, is The Crisis, and there Du Bois are there. They found The Crisis at the same time they found the NAACP on the 100th anniversary of Lincoln's birth. It is interracial. It is involved in legal struggles. The Grand versus U.S. case, and outlaws the Grandfather Clause. It's fighting for that. And the Grandfather Clause was the notion that if your grandfather didn't vote, you wouldn't be able to vote. So it quickly fights for the rights of African Americans all over. The magazine, it starts, it's called The Crisis magazine there. And The Crisis magazine starts with many different issues on many different topics. The next year, he publishes his seminal book, John Brown. He often said that was his favorite book. He wrote it from head, no documents, no footnotes. He wrote it in tribute to John Brown. As we said, the NAACP is founded at Harper's Ferry. Now, as you know, he had this great appreciation for John Brown. Do you remember what Douglas said about Brown? I have lived the life of a slave. He died to end slavery. Who was the better man? And for Douglas, it was John Brown. He said it was probably his worst book, but also his most enjoyable book there. And since then, of course, many books have been written about this man, John Brown. The next year, he goes international. He found something called the Pan-African Movement. The Pan-African Movement is a movement to bring forth Africans and people from Africa and the Caribbean, blacks in Latin America and the United States together for an international conference to speak about the oppression of black people. And he wrote the same year something to the nations of the world, and it was a plea signed by all these leaders. And here you can see there to develop policies to decolonize the African countries, to bring equality to blacks, to stop the lynchings, to stop the terror, to stop the robbing of the resources of Haiti and Ghana and Guinea and many other places. He starts this, and by 1919, it has developed so much that they can now call for a Pan-African Congress, which is called in Manchester, England. They had five of those between 1919 and 1945. He'd wanted to have the first in America, in the United States, in New York, but Woodrow Wilson would not allow the other delegates a visa. They did not want these blacks to come in. Remember, by 1919, many Africans had fought in World War I with the French forces, the Senegalese, the Guinean forces. Many blacks, such as James Reese Europe, have gone and fought with European forces, and they've come back to America. They went to France and got great diggings. In America, they were just treated the same as they were before. And this is the first international gathering of the people of color, period. During that same time, World War I had started, and Du Bois, for the first time, falters, really. During World War I, he called for Americans and soldiers to close ranks. And what he said is, now is not time for political education. It's time to close ranks and fight against the German forces. And many black leaders criticized him. You mean put down all of our desires and all of our struggles that we've been pushing all these years to close ranks for an army and a people who don't accept us at home. So it created a great debate amongst the soldiers there. And he had these ideas. You see, in the crisis, we make no ordinary sacrifice, but we make it gladly and willingly with our eyes lifted to the hills. And here, as he's saying that, this is the great James Rhys Europe, the great and noble Cecil. These are the great founders of modern jazz there. And this is the 369th Regiment out of Harlem. Of course, the 372nd came out of Washington, D.C. And as I told you, the story, perhaps I didn't, is they go to France and they're playing this jazz, this version. And all of a sudden, people looking up, what is this? The French looking bewildered. And then they hear it is the Marseillaise. When they see that, they applaud in glory. And the French have never stopped liking jazz, and jazz musicians have never stopped liking France. But as Du Bois writes that in the criticism, and then he changes his tune, because politicians and people change, and he writes later on, as people come back from the war, we return fighting, we return to fight, we shall be victorious. And he's calling again for African Americans to join together. And of course, that's in the midst of 1919 riots, which I spoke to you before, where many soldiers who had fought in the war come home, including Washington, D.C., and are brutally lynched. As he's moving, the rise of another popular figure comes, and that is Marcus Messiah Garvey, born in Queen Anne, Jamaica, a very dark-skinned man, eloquent speaker, very loquacious, and builds a bass many times more than what Du Bois and all the others together, because he plays on the sentiments of African people, of black people as African people, who've never deeply gotten the rights. There. And he plays in the bass, and he walks around in military uniform. The women are dressed in white, such as the Eastern Stars, and creates a great, wonderful organization. But it's based on one notion, and that is of the Back to Africa movement, assuming that that he will be able to go there. Where in Africa? We don't know. You don't know where you're from. You don't know what country you're from. You know what region. As I mentioned perhaps once before, Oprah Winfrey for years, I thought she was Zulu because she wanted to be like Mandela. She takes the DNA test and she finds that she's Igbo or something from West Africa. But she finds that she is 100% black. There's no white blood that is mixing her family. Oprah Winfrey, so she's pure black and she's a billionaire. You couldn't be better than that, in my opinion. And so Garvey was, of course, deeply suspicious of. He walks into the NAACP office one day, and he looks, and everybody is, as they say, light, bright, and almost white. And as Du Bois is criticizing him because he has this narrow base of just wanting to go back to Africa, Garvey is, of course, chastising and criticizing Du Bois, too. And we'll in another class, we'll deal with their great differences over political philosophy and things like that. A couple of years later, Du Bois, Marcus Garvey, tries to form the Black Star Line, a ship line that's going to go to and take Africans back to some ports in Africa. It fails. The ship cannot get out of the port. It takes a lot of money to run it. I spent a couple of years working on big ships. It takes a lot of money to run a ship and to repair it. And he had bought a second-hand ship. It didn't get out of the water. During the period of time, then, Du Bois is constantly disillusioned with American society, and he feels that more radical answers should be developed. He has a contradiction within the NAACP. You remember that during the Scottsboro case, when these nine young African-American men are pulled off a train and accused of raping white women, the NAACP takes no action. It takes no action because the NAACP is very leery of taking on any case that, number one, it thinks it can't win, and number two, if they think the people may have been guilty. We find out the young black boys were absolutely not guilty, had been accused of something that they would know they were not involved in. He become disillusioned with the role of the NAACP under his leadership of Walter White. And he moves steadily to the left. Now, he had, as I said to you, he had studied in Germany. So in Germany, he had started reading some of these works. The Bible, of course, Critique of Poor Reason, by Origin of the Species, by Darwin, thank you. And Karl Marx's Das Kapital. And he reads especially the preface to the condition on political economy. And there he writes about critique of the of political economy. And there he writes that just as a human error cannot judge itself by that particular error, men cannot judge each other by what they do at that particular time. And it's not the man who determines his consciousness. It is the consciousness that determines the man's reasoning. In essence, it is not you who determine your external conditions, but external conditions help form who you are and help you. And your conditions of life help form your consciousness about things. One does not have to be a working man to understand the plight of working people, but or working people who work every day do understand the plight a little bit better. So he was trying to use philosophical understandings to understand, to look at the problems of the world. And he used that critique to write one of the great books of American history, The Black Reconstruction, which and what he basically says in this book, he treated the black slaves as workers who were exploited. The book came out in 1935, reviewed in almost every publication in the country, from the Atlantic Monthly to the Nation to all the black press. But it's panned by the NAACP and also panned by the mainstream white press. But a couple of years later, Eric Foner, the great Columbia historian, Pulitzer Prize winner, wrote a revisionist history of black reconstruction, of Reconstruction, and gave great praise to this original work. Because he was channeling the Dunning School and others, and many of the earlier schools had said Reconstruction was a failure. It led to the rape of whites by blacks. It led to the tearing up of the South. Even though, if you look at the records, there were very few examples of African-American men actually raping white women, but many, many examples of the lynchings, as I've given you in your chart. And so Du Bois is going back to his scholarship. He has a role. He's back and forth with the NAACP because of his differences. But then something happens. 1937, this organization is founded, the Southern Negro Youth Congress. Esther Jackson, she's now 98. She's my godmother. This is the great Paul Robeson. I think if you saw the film the other day, you see these names. And here, young people from the South: James Jackson from Richmond, Esther Jackson from Cooper from Arlington, Louis Burnham, born in Guyana, Dorothy Burnham, his wife, who just turned 100, and they moved down South. All these Northerners moved down South to find this organization that's going to fight for democracy. And at its founding, two people are there, the two greatest Americans living at the time, in my opinion: Paul Robeson — we'll deal with Robeson at length another time — and of course W.B. Du Bois. And it becomes very active in the South. And here again are some of the pictures of the founders, Dorothy Burnham and many others. The Southern Negro Youth Congress, therefore, is the predecessor to organizations like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It's based itself on the principle of revolutionary democracy. Du Bois continues to fight and continues to be active and plays a major role as a consultant to the founding of the United Nations in San Francisco. He's there because he wants to bring together discuss the plight of the African nations as was espoused in the Pan-African Congresses. As he goes there, of course, soon he comes in conflict with Mrs. Roosevelt. Mrs. Roosevelt, of course, the grand dame of American political society, as she would go and work with blacks in the South, she was chastised. As she fought for the rights of blacks in Washington D.C. when Mary Anderson could not perform at the Constitution Hall, Mrs. Roosevelt is there. When she goes to meetings and blacks and whites in the front and blacks in the back, or whites on one side and blacks on the other side, she takes her chair and she sticks it in the middle. To show. And she also becomes a great leader. She fights for the institution of the Dyer anti-lynching bill. Her husband, Franklin, would not sign an anti-lynching bill because if he signed it, he felt he would lose the votes of the South. And also because he's going to Warm Springs, Georgia every year in Klan country, where because of his condition of his legs, he goes into the hot springs. But his wife does not demur. She fights. But they disagree on the pace of Du Bois and Mrs. Roosevelt disagree on the pace of that. And soon after that, in 1947, he presents the UN with an appeal to the world, and it's mainly appeal to help the colored people of the world. The next year, he becomes involved in a campaign, I guess, would be somewhat similar to Bernie Sanders' campaign, the 48 election. The man, of course, there is Henry Wallace, and of course the great Paul Robeson. Wallace had been the vice president under Roosevelt, but he was dumped in favor of Harry Truman, who later becomes president. He found they worked with something called a Progressive Party. And many of the progressive actors and entertainers, as there are many with Mr. Sanders, some with, of course, Mrs. Clinton, some, of course, with Mr. Trump, some, of course, who were with Mr. Bush, but here the Progressive Party and ideas. Now, understand, Du Bois, when he was in Germany at the turn of the last century, he sees the movement of the German socialists, German, not the National Socialists, but the German Social Democrats, the progressive group. During this period of time also, as the Progressive Party forms, the Cold War is developing. The Americans and Russians had been allies during the war, but now they are bitter at hand. So the Progressive Party starts bringing out ideas of corporate control and the rights of African Americans, the rights of African Americans to vote, the rights of women, and many activists have become involved. Du Bois, Paul Robeson, and of course the late Pete Seeger, who just died about a year ago. He also becomes involved in issues around Africa and found something called the Council of African Affairs. A couple of years ago, you all remember there's something called Trans-African. Trans-Africa is the movement that led the struggle against apartheid. But before Trans-Africa, there was the Council of African Affairs. And it was led by a man named Doxie Wilkerson. Doxie Wilkerson was the provost at Howard University and gave up his position as provost in order to work for these causes. He was a member of the Communist Party. The FBI found out and did everything it could for him never to work again. Robeson, as far as I know, was never a member of the Communist Party, but he never denounced communism anyway. The Council of African Affairs, also led by Alpheus Hunton, who wrote a wonderful book called Decisions on Africa, and perhaps the first great Africanist of the 20th century. And here you see his wife, Dorothy, and Paul Robeson and Dr. Du Bois. As he becomes active in these things, the Cold War is having a tremendous effect. But it's having a tremendous effect at the same time there's a movement to end decolonization. Decolonization in Egypt, decolonization in Vietnam, decolonization in Cambodia, decolonization in Jamaica and throughout the, in Haiti and throughout the West. And he helps organize a peace conference. And forms the Paris conference to support the Paris Peace Accords. And there he's with Victor McIntyre, who was the New York City, famous New York City councilman, and forms the Peace Information Center. But as he's protesting, very close to the White House, he's castigated because he's accused of being a foreign agent. He's no foreign agent because he has said Russia's not our enemy. So they demand that he sign an oath that he's a foreign agent. He refused. And he's handcuffed when he's indicted at Union Square in New York. And he says, I am 83 and have been treated as nothing but a, and you know the words from there. One day I'll play them for you. But he's still there, still sharp as a tack, still proud with his shoes and his Homburg there. And of course, he's getting up in age. And soon he also plays another role in founding this magazine, one of the greatest magazines of the 20th century, again by Esther Jackson, who I've shown you before. And part of it, and others, Jack O'Dell, who became the principal international organizer for Jesse Jackson. And Shirley Graham Du Bois, Nina Gomes, who died some years ago. Shirley Graham Du Bois, a children's book writer, and especially from Africa. And this new magazine, and you can see with all the pictures, it features the writings of Kwame Nkrumah, of Ghana, John Henry Clark, should be John Henry Clark, is a great writer. Paul Robeson, Lorraine Hansberry, Raising in the Sun, James Baldwin, as of course you know, and a great artist, Elizabeth Catlett, the great printmaking artist, who's from Washington, D.C., graduated Dunbar High School a couple of years before Esther Jackson. And her statues are there at the Howard University, but also in Mexico, as she marries Poncho, who was her husband for many years. And, of course, the great Romare Bearden, one of the great leaders of American art. And the publication launches the career of people like Alice Walker and many others. There's no place for progressives to enter and write in, and Harry Belafonte and others. And this magazine becomes the key freedom magazine in the country. But soon, of course, he is getting old. He is disillusioned. And there he is with my godmother, Esther, and Jack, my godfather. He died some years ago. He's in their house. How do they know him? Well, everywhere Du Bois went, there was a circle. And this notion of the talented 10th. The talented 10th was the idea that a 10th of the black population would lead the race to freedom. He developed this notion at the beginning of the century. When he developed this notion, there were 9 million African Americans. 90% were in the South. Of this 9 million, less than 20,000 had a college degree. They were about 700 lawyers, about 250 doctors, about 17,000 blacks educators. They were about 17,000 preachers, but preachers aren't necessarily educated. Preachers, Du Bois once said, the preacher is the most unique individual God has ever produced. Part savant, part hustler, part intellectual, part preacher. He is all things to all people. And the preacher is indeed, the African-American preacher is indeed a very unique and spellbounding, in many cases, progressive individual. But he had this notion of the talented 10th to lead the race, and of course, it did not. He becomes disillusioned, and so in 1961, he decides to join the Communist Party and writes a letter to his chair, W.B. Du Bois. He also leaves, left early and went to Ghana. And he went to Ghana to complete. There he is with Kwame Nkrumah. Kwame Nkrumah has studied at Lincoln University with Langston Hughes. So Kwame Nkrumah founded the Convention Party in Ghana and led the country to independence. And he invited Dr. Du Bois there to work and help complete the book, the Encyclopedia Africana. And there he is at Freedom Hall, and Nkrumah is married to. You see the suit he wears. I have a couple of those there called Nkrumah suits or others. And he's married there, and that's Nkrumah's Egyptian wife. And his 95th birthday, they have in Freedom Hall there. And he became, and his goal was to complete this Encyclopedia of Africana, which was to collect all information on all Africans and people of African descent. And only a couple of years later ago, it was finally reprinted. And completed at Harvard by under the leadership of Henry Gates. And there in Ghana, he had many, many people come as he's completing this work. And Ghana gives him citizenship. He renounces his own U.S. citizenship there. The next year in America, as the March on Washington is being formed, Roy Wilkins was a great man, but Roy Wilkins could not tolerate Du Bois' radicalism. And in many ways, sort of asked him prematurely to take a volunteer retirement. And Du Bois, of course, was fed up with that. He is, after all, Du Bois. He is, after all, trained in Europe. He does have these languages. He's not a mild man. He's not a man who lacks any confidence in himself. But Roy Wilkins comes to the podium and announced the death of W.B. Du Bois, really the leader of the NAACP. The NAACP, who had played a great role in organizing the March on Washington, announces his death. And Dr. King, to end, Dr. King on Du Bois' birthday, February 23rd, 1968, on the 100th anniversary event, held again by Esther Jackson and others at New York's Carnegie Hall in honor of the Freedom Race, then as a fundraiser. And he said, Dr. Du Bois was not only an intellectual giant exploring the frontiers of knowledge, he was in the first place a teacher. He would have wanted his life to teach us something about our task, our emancipation. Dr. Du Bois confronted the powerful structure of historic distortion and demolished it. He did not apologize for being black. And because of it, he was never handicapped. And so this was the life of W.B. Du Bois, perhaps our greatest intellectual. Thank you. Now, I don't know how much time we have, a little time left, so let's have a little a discussion of Dr. Du Bois for next 15 minutes. You all have a sheet I gave you of just some quotes. I find them quite fascinating. But if I were to ask you, what shaped this man? Why did he become what he was? Just off of your head, what would you tell me? Go ahead.
I think because he was educated at such a young age, he was able to, have a love of learning that kind of was expressed throughout his entire life. And that, he realized, was the key to success in both his life and to the advancement of black people in America for, the future generations.
Thank you, because you see, and you're exactly right. It's not enough just to be black or to be oppressed. If you're oppressed, or if you're Jewish and you're oppressed, or if you're Mongolian and you're oppressed, or if you're Hispanic, it's not just enough to feel oppression. You must find ways to fight the oppression. So it's not enough to say that I have been destroyed, but you must find ways. And he saw knowledge as being that way. He saw knowledge as not just being the property of whites, but knowledge to advance the race. And that's why, of course, he had the differences with Du Bois, with Booker T. Washington, because he saw education as a way. And so sometimes if I fuss at you all for not taking advantages of the great advantage you have, well, it's for a reason. You are here, somebody's paying all this money for you, have the great opportunity, no matter what it is, to learn and to explore. And if I say just leave the campuses and go out to the city to learn more about it, it's for a reason, because each of us has a role in society one way or another. And so that was Du Bois' education. Anyone else? What made him, Stephanie?
I think it's also important, like, one of the quotes you have here is, he says, believe in life. I mean, I'm sorry, children will learn better from what you are than what you teach, and he kind of practices what he preaches.
So read it again. Children will.
The quote. Well, I just lost it.
Children will.
Oh, children learn more from what you are than what you teach. And I think it's important to note that he really practices what he preaches.
That's very interesting. I have two children. And, you know, I wasn't always a teacher. I was a working man most of the time, and my wife was, and I was struggling to get the kids through school. And I got them into one of these fancy schools up the street, St. Albans National Cathedral. And one of my friends said, "Maurice, you can't send your kids there. They may learn, but they won't understand by being black." So I laughed at him. I said, in my house, he would just know. It's no problem, because he would learn by me being. And not that black is something all in itself, but he would learn from my dignity. He would learn from the books. He and she would learn from the books in the house. They would learn from the company who comes in. They would learn from the affection that we give them. They would also learn from the demonstrations we go to and the marches. And they would learn by watching how hard their mother works as I'm trying to go to school and the sacrifices of a mother. They would learn all those things. And so it's not always what you say, it's who you are. So as you walk around the campus and walk with your head held high, then that sets an example. Something else on Du Bois that made him. What else made him? Go ahead.
I would add that what made him was not only studying what was happening, but also actually going down. Like, for example, when he was writing the Philadelphia Negro, when he actually went down and saw the conditions that people were living in, because there was a, if I remember, it was written with, like, in the backdrop of Plessy versus Ferguson, and the idea that people thought that it was possible to be separate but equal, but very clearly when he went down there, it was not.
Okay. Thank you very much. So he goes to Philadelphia. It is an aftermath of some years after Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal, and he goes in Philadelphia, the birthplace of American democracy, and he sees the conditions of African America, and is the first that later on Gunnar Myrdal, the Swedish, does something called the American Dilemma. But here, Du Bois is doing this hard nitty-gritty work from neighborhood to neighborhood, asking questions, surveying. In another class tonight, we will look at a book called Talia's Corner, which is about Washington, D.C., and the struggles of people. And it's a study, a person just went in one neighborhood, but Du Bois went in this whole city. I'm doing a study for the city in Washington, D.C., and trying to find about why so many African-Americans have been forced out. But the problem is that the city government and the planners and people keep the statistics have no systematic way of keeping it. It's almost as if they didn't care. I suppose they do, but it's almost as if they didn't care. And so many African Americans are being forced out, and the city changes so much. And people who decry gentrification, yet in some ways are happy with it, because it creates a neighborhood where there are more young, well-off faces. But what about the people who've been forced out? So Du Bois' study was the first to really look at that. Day by day, educational, economic. You see, people talk about poverty, and often it's not understood. We have poverty in Washington, D.C. You have a kid who's 13, or well, let's say 6 or 7, and he's behind or she's behind because they didn't have the chance to go to preschool. And why don't they have these opportunities? Chances are maybe they're 6, maybe their mother's 20. And maybe the mother had a child very young and didn't had the opportunity or didn't take the opportunity. And I often go, the days I'm not teaching, I walk up to the corner store where I live, and I talk to Mo, and Mo is from Guinea. And we'll sit down and talk about African things like that, just get a cup of coffee before I go home and start reading and writing. And young kids will come into the store, 4, 5, and 6, and they're coming in to get candy and things like that when they should be in preschool, but they're not. And so if that person is 6, then their mother is what? Maybe 20, 22. And then their grandfather is maybe 42, and the great-grandfather is maybe 62. So it's not just the generation, it's generations that have preceded them that may not have had opportunities. And, of course, there's an African-American man. The 7% of African-American men never finish high school in D.C. on time, which means, and if they have a record, then good job, they are not able to get them. So Du Bois is doing this study, but we've not learned as much about this study because we are not engaged in the day-to-day work to try to understand. It's not enough to say what the social problems are. One must try to solve them. Du Bois also founded these organizations. So he's not just the intellectual, he's an organizer. And what does that say about him? Now, you know, Dr. King was a great speaker, and they said all the jokes are that he couldn't organize himself out of a paper bag. But see, he didn't have to, because all he had to do was figure out the theory. He's with you, he's marching, so why was he necessary to do the day-to-day work? But in Du Bois, as he's organizing, he's not writing the leaflets. Today to organize is quite simple. You hashtag or you tweet or something like that, come out to them, people come out. But this is a different day. One has to do leaflets and has to develop, and they have to buy the paper, and they have to set the leaflets, they have to set the print, and get the leaflets, and then they have to go out and distribute them. So it's not as easy as it was before. If one wants to find a movement around Pan-Africanism, one has to get up and go to Paris and go to these other countries and meet these leaders. And so he has this unique ability to organize, but in a different way, by pure intellect. And of course, as you look at his work, I'd be remiss without saying that Du Bois is one of the early writers on the condition of African-American women. He has a great appreciation of the role of African-American women. He wrote other books, Dark Water, Dark Princess, and many others that he appreciates. And why? I suppose for the same reason I do, because he was raised by a single mother, and he was raised there, and he saw how hard she worked to produce for him. So he always had that great affinity. So he's making this list. It's part in jest, he says it. But he does have great, and then he, of course, has a daughter, Du Bois. Du Bois, her first name, Burkhart, the son, and then his daughter, and then even when he marries again, Shirley Graham, he has a great appreciation for that. And let's ask one more question. Why do you suppose Du Bois saw the need to leave America? It's very complex. He's participated in the struggles around World War I, World War II, the founding of the United Nations. He writes books. He goes down south to stop lynchings. But then, at a certain point, he feels necessary to leave. No one should ever feel that way, but he felt the necessity to leave at the age of perhaps 91. And what's happening during that time? What's happening in the early 60s? And concurrently on the other side, what is happening?
Opposition to the civil rights movement.
Well, opposition to the civil rights movement. But the great period of political repression that starts with the McCarthy period, starts in the early 50s, starts right after World War II is ended, and lasts for generations, where people like Du Bois are arrested, where Paul Robeson's passport is taken, where my godfather, Jack, there was put in a jail and did something called run underground, which means he didn't see his wife for 4 or 5 years as he has to go and live in a farm somewhere in Idaho because the FBI is chasing him because he's accused of being a communist. And perhaps he wasn't. Everybody had to sign a lawyer's law. So it's a great period of political repression. You have other things, the Bay of Pigs and invasion in Cuba, Americans, contradiction with Russia that had been his allies, the space race, all those things. But thousands of blacks whose passports are taken, many are denied the jobs. One has to sign a loyalty oath. Have you ever been? If you saw the movie Trumbo, you saw what is happening in Hollywood. Many great writers are blacklisted, lose jobs, and a great period of political repression. And so Du Bois feels that. In fact, enough credit is not given to Martin Luther King because it is a civil rights movement and it's fighting and bringing in people like Bob Dylan and Pete Seeger and Dick Gregory and Harry Belafonte and many other leaders like that across the board that helps bring in, usher in the end of the Cold War. But he has to leave because of that. And then Du Bois goes to Africa, but he goes there with the mission that he always wanted, and that was to write this magazine, write this book, Encyclopedia Africana. So we'll end with that and have a nice break and think about what you're going to write your next papers on. And always, when you write your next papers, hope they're better than the first ones, and they will always be. And thank you. So, and I'll give papers. I'll give you papers out today, and then we can discuss them. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to C-SPAN's Lectures in History. Be sure to check out our Q&A podcast for intriguing hour-long conversations with people who are making things happen. On this week's episode, Jessica Dulong talks about her book Saved at the Seawall, which tells the story of the largest and fastest maritime evacuation in history, which occurred on September 11, 2001, when over 500,000 people were taken off the island of Manhattan by boat. Find it and follow wherever you get your podcasts.